This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of November 29th, 2020. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 162. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support the Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. The Is It Just Me commentary. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. And the big deal feature, Vancouver through two plagues, the 1918-1919 Spanish flu and COVID-19. Hear guests Margaret Andrews, Associate Professor Emerita of History at the Washington State University, and Andy Yan, the Director of the City Program at Simon Fraser University. Now, is it just me? Is it just me, or is it time for the NDP government to get back to work? The 42nd Parliament in British Columbia is set to open December 7th. The 57 NDP, 29 BC Liberal, and 2 BC Greens were sworn in last week. A new cabinet was also announced. The politicians were in a self-congratulatory mood, especially the NDP ones. It can't, won't, and shouldn't last long. We're in a pandemic and about to have the most somber Christmas and Hanukkah season since World War II. To put it into perspective, between September 21st, when John Horgan called the snap election, and November 26th, when John Horgan's cabinet was sworn in, there were 21,756 new cases of the virus announced and 157 deaths. That's 40% of all deaths from the virus in BC and 72% of all cases in BC. The election was scheduled for fall of 2021, but John Horgan wanted more power quicker, even if it meant putting politics ahead of public health. It has been said that the worst day in government is better than the best day in opposition. But that won't really be true for the NDP because governing only becomes more difficult in the second wave, while British Columbians wait longer than their Washington State neighbors for a vaccine. What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news.
News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In Apple Daily, four Chinese doctors stole organs from the dead. Wang Xinli, Lu Shen, Yang Shuchun, and Wang Hailang were handed jail sentences of between 1 year to 2 years and 4 months by an Anhui court in July. They lost an appeal in August. Details of the case only emerged last week after Chinese newspaper The Paper obtained the judgment from victims' family members. The doctors also fabricated documents to legitimize the stolen organs, the report said. It was not reported if any or how much profit the six people had made from the scheme. In the Japan Times, over 40% of Japan's hospitals cutting bonuses as pandemic bites. The bonus cuts are mainly due to patients avoiding regular visits to the doctor or refusing to be hospitalized out of fear of catching the coronavirus, according to the Japan Federation of Medical Workers Unions. Earlier this month, it asked labor unions at medical institutions throughout the country to take part in the survey. It received answers from 298 unions by Wednesday. And ABC News Australia, China puts tariffs on Australian wine, a blow for the $1.2 billion a year industry. China has accused Australian producers of selling wine for below the cost of production. China's Commerce Ministry gave informal instructions to importers to suspend orders of wine and six other types of Australian exports earlier this month. Shares in Treasury Wine Estates, one of Australia's largest exporters, plunged 11%. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In the Oregonian, Portland spends $65,000 to remove protest graffiti from businesses, homes. Mayor Ted Wheeler and Commissioner Chloe Udaly earmarked $100,000 to cleanups in July, 2 months into nightly protests against police racism. The existing program has a $200,000 annual budget. People have routinely spray-painted slogans and messages onto private property across Portland during racial justice demonstrations. In the Seattle Times, Washington liquor agents followed and confronted after notifying bar of COVID-19 violation. It happened after they served a notice of violation at Coco's Bartini in Kennewick this week. It was the fourth time liquor control officers have visited the bar since it refused to end indoor service as required by Governor Jay Inslee's pandemic safety mandate starting November 18th. The ban on indoor drinking and dining at restaurants and bars across the state is in effect until at least December 14th, as new COVID-19 cases across the state skyrocket and some hospitals elsewhere in the state are at capacity. Coco's Bartini has posted photos of customer signs saying, "Bartini Lives Matter will not comply," and "My choice, you stay home." In Czech news, COVID-19 concerns especially high in Qualicum Beach due to recent cases. Residents say the town's streets are quieter, the feeling is different, and people are taking COVID-19 precautions much more seriously. Island Health says the Central Island region was the home of the highest number of cases on Vancouver Island. In Qualicum Beach, there was a COVID-19 case at a hardware store. The Legion remains closed after a member tested positive, a possible exposure at Qualicum Secondary School, and there may be more. That's Cascadia Calling this week in the Breaker.News podcast. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. As we enter December, we are in the second wave of the coronavirus pandemic here in British Columbia, the worst health crisis since the 1918-1919 Spanish flu epidemic. How did British Columbia cope back then? What can we learn from history? Friends of the Vancouver City Archives host an online fundraising talk on December 3rd. It's called Vancouver Through Two Plagues, the 1918-1919 Spanish Flu and COVID-19. With Margaret Andrews, Associate Professor Emerita of History from the Washington State University, and Andy Yan, the Director of the City Program at Simon Fraser University. Influenza reached Vancouver on October 5, 1918, and spread rapidly, more than 500 cases by October 22, 1918, with 24 deaths reported 5 days later. Another wave in January 1919, and a third wave in March 1919. Margaret wrote Epidemic and Public Health, Influenza in Vancouver, 1918-1919, for BC Studies, and she found that 30,000 people took ill, 900 people died when Vancouver had just 100,000 residents. Looking back at research in newspapers of the day, it's eerie how history has repeated in so many ways. Here is Andy Yan and Margaret Andrews.
Looking back at research and newspapers of the day, how eerie is it to you that history has repeated in so many ways?
Well, I think if you have an epidemic, there are certain similarities that are inevitable. There are vast differences, but when you get sick and people get scared, human nature tends to say they react in many similar ways. Although the microorganism is different, as we know.
But back then, as we've had in 2020, there was a pressure to close stores, pressure to close schools, pressure to close churches, to keep people away from each other, to stop spreading that influenza. There was also a pushback that there were people in the clergy, especially, that weren't happy to see churches closed. We're seeing a bit of that today. And of course, the big issue of debate, masks, so that people would keep their droplets in.
Well, and actually in Vancouver, in terms of the discussion among city council, the medical health officer, masks was not a big issue. Schools, open or closed, big issue. And in photographs, you'll find masks were being worn. They were being manufactured locally, but it wasn't the issue it is today, at least not in Vancouver.
Yeah, there was an anti-mask league in San Francisco that got some attention.
Big cultural a difference. The lonely frontierman standing on the ridge is a good American tradition. It's the Mountie helping people over the pass is a Canadian equivalent.
Now, Andy, some things that you've seen some trends today that were echoed back then. In the back pages of newspapers, that can be compared with what we're seeing today on social media.
Yeah, indeed. I always thought it was one of the things that I was always curious about was that, okay, well, obviously here we have Twitter, we have the various kind of social media channels that we have today. And I was always curious, like, was there some kind of analog from 1918 that we could perhaps kind of have a small view of what would, possibly be like an equivalent of a Twitter or of really various other voices aside from reporters and the officials. And I figured it might be the ads in the back that when you look at the ads of the same era, that's I think bringing out the stories that Margaret had brought out in her research. One is quite astounded about the kind of, dare I say, quackery that is quite prolific in that time, coming out in the ads, in the promises of a cure or some kind of prevention in catching the flu or preventing the flu. And it was just interesting seeing how those promises, those hopes, those fears can be seen in those back page ads of the newspapers of that era.
Yeah, your ads are you're quite right. They were wonderful. And camphor was what everybody wanted to buy. We have our toilet paper run. There it was, camphor. And the pharmacists made a terrific profit. The price went from about 40 cents a unit to over $6. And there was huge upset. So yeah, and the ads, there was one that urged you to buy a new Ford car if you were tired of having damp feet waiting for the streetcar. And this was taking advantage of the fear of being in the car. It was in the streetcar. It was a stuffy environment, and it wasn't safe. So buy a Ford car. Another ad.
Wow. Well, I think what's also interesting, Bob and Margaret, I don't know if you saw this, but the discussion of a serum, like I guess the equivalent of the discussion of a vaccine today. That it was fascinating to see this discussion of a serum and how, you know, they were in search of a serum to cure the flu.
Well, they had very limited preventives. They had smallpox vaccination, which went way back. And then they had diphtheria antitoxin, which was a modern vaccine in our sense, but it had to be given in the very early stages of the disease. So it wasn't really as useful a preventative. But all these measles, chickenpox, whooping cough, all these, you just got them and you were quarantined and you survived in most cases. So the serum thing, I suspect it was a bit of a quack cure, but I don't know that. I don't think, although I didn't come across any scientists looking at it and analyzing it.
Right.
Sugar water.
Now, the Spanish flu came to British Columbia in the later stages of the First World War in 2018. It was interesting that back then, that year, when this the sickness was starting to spread across the world, that there was one bigger story, and that was the First World War, even though the front of the war was far removed from the west coast of Canada. A lot of people had friends and relatives that were involved in the war effort. This year, it was the U.S. presidential election that dominated media attention, and Donald Trump, with all his bombast, dominating media attention in a similar fashion that was actually overshadowing the pandemic. But looking back in the fall of 1918, I found some interesting parallels. And Margaret, you wrote about it in your research about the human fly that Vancouver had this entertainment exhibition that packed people on streets, and it reminded me of what was going on here on Halloween with people looking for entertainment on the Granville Mall, gathering in too many people on the Granville Mall, but not as many people as came together to see the human fly perform back in Vancouver on October 31st, 1918.
He was called Harry Gardner, the human fly, and he climbed up the Hotel Vancouver of the day. But, you know, there were large gatherings apart from that. There were Victory Loan gatherings outdoors. And there were also masses of people coming to the train station to meet the troops as they came back, because there were several trainloads of soldiers from the front who were returning to Vancouver before peace. Actually, Vancouver had a huge gathering on November 7th, which was a fake armistice. And then the real armistice on the 11th, they once again came out and gathered in huge numbers. So in terms of spread, lots of outdoor opportunities. But the incubation period was so much shorter that indeed the spread from a mass gathering would be evident within 1 to 4 days. So that's a huge difference there. I do think within the province, there was clear dissent between the various cities, their health officers, and Vancouver. Vancouver was a bad boy in the books of most of the city health officers, Victoria certainly, and also I think Henry S. and Young, the provincial health officer. He stepped back to a considerable extent, but he was really wishing Vancouver would get on the bandwagon. And that would be just in the first 10 days, 15 days of the epidemic. After that, things changed.
Andy, you specialize in urbanism, looking at cities. What is there that Vancouver of 2020 can learn from Vancouver of 1918-19 when it comes to responding to a health emergency like this? How should we change our cities, and what should we learn from this? What should be the legacy of this?
Well, I think that's a really interesting question, because in one way, we have almost 100 years of science, of technology, one might say hubris, of what's happened back then compared to what it is today. And yet it's weird how a lot of this is actually how history isn't linear. It's almost cyclical, that you see it. And then for me, reading through not only Margaret's articles, but then also going through the original kind of pieces in The Sun and in the Daily Province, to kind of see how there's almost this cyclical approach of how human beings are still human beings, in who do they trust, what do they hear, what do they do. And I think that in this type of conversation, I think it's something how we're still working at it, that it's a process through which it's the question of building trust, it's the question of collective action, I think, through which actually perhaps we can have a certain comfort in our technology and in really what's happened. But yet, I think seeing what happened before and yet now seeing certain, I think, things edge out in terms of the inequalities, of the really the effects of inequality, of how and I think the parallels, well, on scale, because I again, taking great interest of what Margaret did and then projecting it and applying it towards the statistics that we have of our population today, it wasn't even close. Like when you look at the effects of the flu on that population of that size, and if you were to project that into what is the population today, like we're talking about like a Michael Crichton-esque biblical, catastrophe kind of level if we were to take those numbers. But yet at the same time, you look at how COVID has kind of really amplified the kind of gaps that occur on social economic lines, on labor, that I think that's actually one of the really interesting things, and the interesting parallel of how we're not necessarily engaging those issues, that we look at the issue of frontline workers, and certainly what happened and affected frontline workers and first responders back in 1918. I think what's interesting for me is to see how, again, in spite of all the technology and all the data we have in 2020, we don't necessarily even take into the concerns. And I think that I'm working on another project to actually look into it, to actually look at how really COVID-19 is going along those lines of inequality and those lines of labor, through which I think would present, I think, some very uncomfortable truths that perhaps are as uncomfortable now as they were in 1918.
I found it very interesting that back in 1918, that there were school teachers that were being called into, basically seconded into hospitals to work as nurses. And after a while, they got fatigued. So there were calls for men to join in and work in the hospitals. There were labor issues back then. And some of the newspapers of the day did mention how it was affecting some ethnic groups, although it wasn't the level of coverage, of course, was minimal. But there were some stories about how it was affecting indigenous communities around the province. That word did travel down into Vancouver, down into Victoria, and there were some concerns expressed in some stories that it wasn't entirely ignored, but even then they were looking at the impacts, the spread of the virus.
Right. My personal favorite is is a headline in on February 6, 1917 from the Vancouver Daily World, which in part talks about how, with the flu and how the Oriental population takes wages of sin. And really, and you know, I mean, how quaint that in that type of conversation, I'm going like, well, that's actually a few years behind great-granddad landed around later on in about the 20s. So, you know, the Yan presence in Vancouver wasn't there yet. But yet at the same time, going deeper into actually, well, okay, what kind of wages of sin are we talking about? And when you go deep into that particular article, it's actually overcrowding. It actually is, you know, the concerns. And this is, you know, it's a part of the historic record of how different groups were dealing with the issue of housing and of accessible housing, of really the challenges of Vancouver back then, as much as it's about the challenges of Vancouver today in terms of affordable, accessible housing. And in this case, the cases of flu was just running rampant in the overcrowded living conditions in places like Chinatown. And you hit numbers of how 5 in 1,000 Chinese Canadians back then, again, I have to double check these numbers, but how 5 in 1,000 cases were coming in Chinatown in terms of fatalities. And you go, wow, and kind of think about, again, how those stories from back in 1918 play out in 2020.
Yeah. Well, there was indeed a Japanese hospital because segregation was the rule of the day. Mm-hmm. But they had Strathcona School, while mm-hmm. the schools were closed, became a Japanese hospital.
Yeah.
The crowding, I think the fact that Vancouver is the end of the railroad, end of a shipping line of sort, I mean, ships come in, means that there were lots and lots of men who were living in rooming houses or cheap hotels. And the relief department would go around and organize volunteers to knock on doors to see if you were sick. In one case, I think they found a dead body, but it was something that they did. They tried to check on the poverty in housing that was poor, but it was not in time to do much good in terms of saving their lives. In many cases, they would be very, very, very sick at that point. And that's very much like today, as you say. But what is interesting is that the volunteer organizations with the employers and with the city were able to very efficiently get volunteer inspectors and shared contributions to what would have been called the relief element of the population. And that was all done, well, it was with an operation within the first month when they were still closed down, which is amazing in terms of speed. We seem to talk a lot and before we actually get the things in place.
That was my interview with Margaret Andrews and Andy Yan, who were previewing their December 3rd talk to the Friends of the Vancouver City Archives, Vancouver Through Two Plagues, the 1918-1919 Spanish Flu and COVID-19. For more information about the fundraiser, go to fovca.com.
Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo bar to a person or group that is making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to the people behind the Movember movement. They're aiming to reduce the number of men dying prematurely by 25% by the year 2030. The Mustache Growing November fundraiser, that's where you get Movember from, is in its 17th year. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca.
Conquer.
That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of November 29th, 2020. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on November 29th in 1899, FC Barcelona was founded? One of its stars was the legendary Diego Maradona, who died last week at age 60. Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to Bob at thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's P-A-T-R-E-O-N.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.